Hi, this is Sally with 800 CEO Reads Knowledge Blocks, and thank you for joining us on this conversation with Lawrence Weinzimmer, who, with Jim McConaughey, has authored the new book, The Wisdom of Failure, How to Learn the Tough Leadership Lessons Without Paying the Price. Welcome, Larry. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sally. Glad to be here.
Well, we're really excited to talk about your book today because I think failure, and previously, a couple of years ago, we started seeing some books about making mistakes, embracing the idea that we are sort of, I guess, human. And here we've moved into this idea that, or this question, in fact, about the validity or the efficacy of looking at failure as a way to learn rather than maybe following in the successful footsteps of other organizations or other leaders. So let's start out. If you could explain a little bit the thesis of Wisdom of Failure and whether it's a book that gives examples or case studies of companies and leaders who have failed and is thus a blueprint for readers to avoid failure, or is it more of a book with advice on how to learn from your own failure, or is it a bit of both?
Actually, Sally, it's all of the above. And so you mentioned the efficacy of learning from failure. Does it really change the way we perform? And so the study started out with 7 years of research, taking a look at almost 1,000 leaders across 21 industries to prove exactly that there is efficacy in learning from failure. And what we found in this research was that not only do individuals perform better on their jobs, but cultures or companies that create cultures where you can learn from failure actually perform better in terms of financial bottom line as well. And the book actually does have both case studies and specific examples of not only leaders who have failed and how they've succeeded through that, but really to provide readers with the ability to learn from others' mistakes as well. And so, you know, you can only fall off the corporate ladder so many times before you're deemed an ineffective leader. And so it's those leaders that can actually learn not only from their own failures, but from others' failures that are the ones that become most effective.
I found it interesting that this is just in your introduction, but you described the three phases of research that you and your co-author did. And again, one of them was investigating just how effective it is to learn from mistakes. But then you also talked about the fact that you interviewed, as you mentioned, so many people for this book, but you also found retired CEOs to be more open about talking about their mistakes, which in fact changed your approach to gathering the personal stories based on maybe the current CEO's reticence on talking about that. Is that a self-awareness issue? Is it a, you know, you don't want to open the closet door kind of issue? Or and what kind of stories did you hear from these retired CEOs?
And I think it was more of the latter. It's open the closet door issue. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to talk about failure. And in many organizations, it's actually become taboo. So, it was a three-phase study. And it started out, as I mentioned, with that broad study of almost 1,000 leaders. And then we ran focus groups after that to try to find the most common mistakes or failures that leaders make. And finally ended with interviews. And we were very fortunate to be able to interview some of the leading CEOs around the country. And what we found was oftentimes they didn't want to talk about failure. And so what we had to do was start interviewing former CEOs because, again, they didn't have any skin in the game anymore, so they were more open to talk about it. And one of the big surprises was we had some great interviews with, again, sitting CEOs. One of them, you would know the individual's name, but I cannot mention it. I said I would not.
Sure.
But he's the CEO of a Fortune 50 company. Had a great interview with them, gave us some great information that we wanted to share with readers, only to call back the next day and say, you know what, I thought about it, and I don't want to be part of this project. It's a project on failure, and I'm not comfortable being associated with it. And I tried to tell him it's actually, we know it's a him now, that there's enough. I told him that
the odds are in the favor that would be true.
Yeah,
percentages.
Yeah, but I said, you know, it's actually a book on how to be an effective leader by learning from failure. And he still, you know, because the word failure was in there, he didn't want to be associated with it. So it was a difficult task set out to do. But part of our success in gathering the research for this actually was serendipitous timing. we finished the first phase of the research right about the time the recession hit. And it's amazing how profit and revenue can hide failure. And when we hit the recession, all of a sudden people became more open to talking about failure. And so instead of, you know, here's what leaders need to do to be great, the focus shifts to here's what leaders shouldn't do to be great. And so it really, we had an analogy in the book. It's kind of like when a tide goes out unusually far, you can see a part of the ocean that you usually don't see. And that's really what the recession allowed us in terms of collecting the information for the book.
I find that sort of bravery in talking about this subject to be particularly interesting in that, let's take, for example, in the knowledge blocks exploration that we posted on our site last month, I added a video from Jason Fried, the founder of 37 Signals and author of Rework, who has gotten quite a bit of views on a speech that he gave that and an article that he then also presented about sort of being very negative about this idea that we should embrace failure. So in some ways, you were, in order to write this book, you had to really tangle with the emotions that people have about failure, the pride that they deal with when they're talking about failure, and came up against some resistance there. But did you find other people who were very relieved about talking about this subject?
Yeah, and great question. So the interesting thing, especially in the focus groups, it was really difficult to get these leaders in the focus groups to start talking. But once one of them started to talk a little bit about failure, the floodgates opened, and they all talked about failure. And the one thing that we took out of this, or the most consistent message we heard, was their most important lessons as leaders came from their biggest failures.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this paradox. You can't be a successful leader until you know failure. Yet we've created systems, and especially in the U.S., we've created systems where not only do we try to discourage failure or discourage lessons from failure in the workplace, we actually penalize people for trying to learn from failure. Where, you know, let's face it, when you work for an organization, you're paid to succeed, you're not paid to fail. And quite often, lessons from failure, you don't get those lessons unless you have the benefit of hindsight. And so, because we have this pressure to perform in the short term, and again, our performance evaluations are 6 months or a year, if you fail and make a mistake, what a lot of people do, they'll hide it, they'll sweep it under the rug, or worst of all, they'll blame somebody else. And so we've created cultures and organizations where it's really difficult to try to learn those lessons from failure.
I'm going to take this slightly off, away from the book for just a moment, other
sure.
than I was influenced after reading your book last month, that I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who was pondering whether to move her preschooler up a grade in, I think, from a 3-year-old classroom to a 4-year-old classroom for excelling preschoolers. And I had just finished looking at your book, and I thought, you know, we're having this discussion about how that kind of move for young children can be very stressful in terms of academic performance. It can be very stressful in terms of social anxiety. But then reflecting on your book, it also sort of, one of the advices that I gave my friend was the fact that we also have to create this, when we're expecting so much from our children, we also have to create a sort of landing pad for when they do fail, some sort of understanding that when you set the bar really, high, you need to also instill in them a sort of self-forgiveness for the failures that they might sort of achieve on the way. And I found that's one way that your book goes beyond just talking to the business leader, but can also talk about how we act as a culture.
Yeah.
I think, since you were mentioning that it is sort of culturally ingrained,
yeah,
this fear of failure.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the example you just gave, a couple takeaways on that. First of all, the more risk you take, the more likely you are to fail. And so organizations that realize this actually are more innovative and more creative. And with the family that was debating whether, and I'm dying to know if they did it or not, but they're debating whether to move their child up a year or not, there's going to be a higher rate of or a higher risk of failure. And so absolutely creating that ability to understand that there's value in failure. As human beings, we will fail. It's inevitable. And it's part of, it's part of what makes us interesting. And so rather than denying that failure occurs, it's to accept it for what it is and actually to grow from it rather than to bury it. And unfortunately, especially when you mentioned preschool, we've created a culture too in the U.S. that we really stress perfectionism. When kids get into kindergarten, first thing that they hear is, well, you need to color inside the lines and don't color outside the lines because that's bad. And well, why is that bad? And so then we hear expressions like you need to strive for perfection or practice makes perfect. And there's that word perfect or perfection. And the more we stress perfection, the more intolerable making mistakes becomes. And so it's a difficult platform that we're creating for many of our kids. And so that example kind of struck a chord with the way we stress perfectionism early on. And again, creating that landing pad that, the more risk you take, the more chance of failure. But over time, and this goes back all the way to finance theory, over time, with risk comes failure, but over time you'll outperform those that don't take risk.
What I like about the wisdom of failure is that as much as there's great value in us talking sort of theoretically about failure, you also offer very, very practical advice in the book. And so let's look at that for a second. You broke the book up into sort of the three most common types of business mistakes. And they are, just to recap for listeners, unbalanced orchestration at the organizational level, drama management at the team level, and personality issues at the individual level. So you have it broken up between the organizational, team, and individual types of business mistakes or failures. Why did you decide to differentiate between the three, and how did that become the structure of your book?
Yeah, great question, Sally. And so what we found in our research, especially at the focus group level, was there were and I'll call them buckets, these three buckets of mistakes that leaders made. And at the very highest level or macro level, unbalanced orchestration, leaders can make strategic mistakes. And there were three common areas under strategic mistakes that leaders made that we found in our research. And then at the team level, or the mid-level, we found that leaders made three very common mistakes in managing their teams. And finally, at the very micro level or individual level, there are personality flaws that can derail a leader's career as well. So we just found these commonalities among these three areas, and that's really how the book was structured. And then within the book, what we did was define what the mistake was, how we give the reader comment or warning signs that they can consider in trying to decide if this is a mistake that they're making or not. And interestingly, a lot of times we found that leaders aren't aware they're making a mistake until, again, hindsight kicks in. As Jim Owens, the CEO of Caterpillar, told us, leadership has a very long tail. So sometimes you don't know about the mistake until it's too late. And then finally, at the end of each chapter, we have our what we call successful navigation, which are keys that leaders need to consider to proactively avoid ever making these mistakes. And so, yeah, it is very practical, and there should be some pretty good takeaways for anybody from a seasoned leader to an aspiring leader.
One of the examples of an organizational strategic mistake that you mentioned is the mistake of yes. You explain, quoting from Michael Porter, that companies who try to be all things to all people have a tendency to fail, and you offer Kmart as an example.
Yeah.
How can the failure of Kmart or companies that make a similar mistake or experience that kind of failure, as Kmart did, file for bankruptcy, I should fill in anyone who isn't aware of that, can instruct leaders on how to say no and what is the value in saying no.
Yeah. And what happens in that chapter, I talk about strategy spaghetti, where what you do is take your strategy spaghetti, throw it up against the wall, and whatever sticks you decide to do. And as you just mentioned, Sally, they don't have strategic direction. And so in the case of Kmart, this was quite some time ago, but for mass merchandisers similar to Kmart, the Walmarts and the Targets of the world, there was a fork in the road. And Target decided to go with, they're going to do a little bit more upscale purchasing or shopping experience for customers, and they went down one fork in the road, and Walmart decided they were going to compete on price. And so the shopping experience isn't maybe as nice as walking around in a Target, but the prices are going to be lower. And so Kmart kind of sat there at the fork in the road for a second. They scratched their heads and decided we're going to go down both. And so they really didn't have any strategic direction, or they didn't have a strategic platform to differentiate themselves from anybody else. And numerous examples of organizations, when they try to be all things to all people, they usually fail. And so, so if you're a leader in an organization, what's the platform that allows you to differentiate and then pursue it, knowing that there's going to be a segment of customers that you probably won't be able to serve by pursuing your source of differentiation.
So then we move on to the drama management at the team level. I'm really interested in how, A, you decided to label it drama management, but one of the sort of subcategories of that you mentioned is dysfunctional harmony, which is also sort of a mind bender a little bit, dysfunctional harmony. So can you tell us a little bit about drama management at the team level and then how dysfunctional harmony is one of the failures that teams can make?
Yeah, you hit on one of my favorite chapters, so I'd love to talk about this one. First of all, with drama management, and why we labeled it this is a common set of mistakes that leaders make is they create unnecessary drama in the workplace when the drama doesn't have to exist. And there are numerous detrimental consequences by doing that, particularly with the case of dysfunctional harmony. Again, it sounds kind of counterintuitive, but it's really the idea of trying to force harmony when harmony doesn't exist. And so this comes out of the example of passive aggressiveness. And in psychology, we talk about passive aggressiveness where somebody acts really nice to you, but then they do mean things to you behind your back. And the same thing happens in organizations. There's a lot of drama created when a leader allows her or his team to act in a passive-aggressive way where face-to-face it seems like we all get along great, but then behind closed doors we stab each other in the back. And actually Booz Allen did a study on this and found this to be what they identified as the most damaging cultural attribute in U.S. organizations today. It's the idea that we're going to tell you what you want to hear to your face, and then we're going to turn around and do something else. And so what it does, it creates a culture or a climate where we're not allowed to have any conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to get along. Everybody should like each other. But as human beings, we don't always get along, and we don't always like each other. And we all know that constructive conflict is actually a good thing, and when you disallow that, it actually hurts the team and the organization.
Right. I was going to bring up the constructive conflict. I know that there's some theory out there about, and this goes back to something you mentioned a little earlier about how organizations that are more creative or more innovative allow for some failure, some amount of failure. And also, I think there's definitely some theory out there that also says that, constructive conflict also helps initiate innovation in a way that sort of harmonious workplaces, obviously to some level, but harmonious workplaces don't allow for that kind of back and forth. Like brainstorming only will get you so far if nobody's actually challenging your ideas.
Exactly correct. Yeah.
And so, we can fear putting our ideas out there in case people see them as being failures, but unless you are able to take that kind of constructive criticism to make that idea better, and that fear of failure takes you over, then that innovation can't happen at
Absolutely.
Any level.
Yeah.
There's a jumping to the personality issues at the individual level. I found one of them to be really interesting, and that is avoiding the mistakes of disengagement. And I thought this was particularly applicable to the conversation because that disengagement, sort of dispassion, is the result of disengagement. Mm-hmm. And so how do you tap into that recognition that is one of your personal individual failures if it is exactly disengagement that's causing your dispassion?
In the disengagement, what happens with disengagement is a leader becomes disimpassioned, disengaged, and they really don't perform as a leader anymore. Employees look for them to, or look to them for direction, and they're so disengaged that they're not able to do so. And it's really the, oftentimes when a leader takes a tool that we all talk about as something being good, like empowerment, and they take it too far. If you consider any of the mistakes or any of the failures we identify in the book, they're all examples of situations where a leader has taken a tool or taken a certain type of behavior too far. And so disengagement is at one end of the spectrum, and the chapter right after that in the book is called hoarding, which is at the far other end of the spectrum where the leader of the organization micromanages and they want to control everything. And so it's really the ability to achieve the balance between those. And so you mentioned, well, as a leader, how do you know if you're doing that or not? With most mistakes in the book, it's really difficult through self-awareness to see if you're making these mistakes or not. And that's why we get into different signs of, mm-hmm. of disengagement, signs of hoarding. Another chapter in that area is self-absorbed leader, so signs of being a self-absorbed leader. And if you can combine that with John Challenger, the leader of Challenger Gray and Christmas, largest exec outplacement, CEO outplacement firm in the country, he said that great leaders are able to find truth tellers. And what a truth teller is somebody you can trust that's going to call it the way it is. And that's so valuable to have. In an interview with George Rubinson, he's a former CEO of Allstate Property Casualty, he said he was driving home one day after work and, you know, realized how lucky a leader he is because he created a team, and the members of that team were not afraid to tell him when they thought he was a little bit off course. And any great leader needs that feedback to know if they need to redirect their actions or behaviors.
That's a great summation, I think, of the lesson of the whole book, is that there needs to be even leaders who are willing to embrace that kind of constructive criticism or embrace their own ways and where their strengths are not, perhaps, mm-hmm. Can ultimately become better leaders by acknowledging what we might call weaknesses or what we might call failures. And as you mentioned, you describe failures as happening most often when strengths become exaggerated or cross the line into becoming failures. And I think this is a really important point in a business culture where strengths are so touted. You know, strengths are the go-to word these days, and everybody wants to play to their strengths. And yet there is a sort of danger there.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we only play to our strengths, and a great example of that is the fine line, or the perceived fine line between being confident and being arrogant. Mm-hmm. And so, again, as an outsider looking in, they look basically the same. But when you look underneath, they're actually, again, at very different ends of the spectrum. So if you see somebody playing to their strengths, they need to be confident, and they start crossing that line so that they feel that they're better than anybody else. That's where the arrogance kicks in. And I like something you said just a couple minutes ago, Sally, when you mentioned that, you know, as leaders, we need to know our weaknesses. And that's exactly, that's the biggest difference between a confident leader and an arrogant leader. A confident leader, they believe they'll succeed. They know what they need to do to succeed, but they also know they're not always going to be the best person, the best go-to person in a certain situation. Where an arrogant leader, they've taken confidence so far that it's crossed that line and they believe that they're better than everyone else. Or even worse yet, it turns into hubris or the belief that they can't fail. And so I absolutely correct on that. That was a great comment.
There's so much good sort of pragmatic advice in this book. What is the one thing, if you know, you're encouraging someone to go and pick up the wisdom of failure, and you want them to know one thing about what this book is going to do for them, what is that thing?
Again, it's that ability to learn from others' mistakes. Jerry Shaheen, he's a board member at Ford, said that good leaders, you know, can learn from their mistakes. Great leaders learn from everyone else's mistakes. And so that ability to, again, the subtitle of the book, to learn the tough leadership lesson without having to pay the price, to develop that skill where you can see what other leaders do well and also what other leaders don't do well and learn from both of those. There's an example in the beginning of the book of Jim Owens, the former CEO of Caterpillar, and he credits his success in leading Cat through the recession and some deem him the darling of Wall Street during that time. He credits his success to the lessons he learned 20 years ago that a leader was making a cat, and he didn't want to emulate those mistakes. And so that ability to learn from others' mistakes as well as your own.
Excellent. Well, I think we will close on that note, and I want to thank you, Larry, for joining us to talk about your book, The Wisdom of Failure, and we highly recommend it to all listeners and readers, not just even business leaders. I think it does have resonance sort of on a cultural level as well, that I think people will really find a lot of value in the book. Thank you again for joining us, and good luck to you and Jim on your book.
Thanks so much, Sally.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.